Hey, it's Daryl C. Murphy, and I just want to talk to you real quick. The Common is produced at WBUR in Boston. We're public media. We don't have paywalls, which means we don't ask you to pay to see our work. We say, here's some powerful stories for free. And then, if some of those stories you read or listen to are important to you, and you talk about it with your friends and family, and you even see the world a little differently, then we ask you to support it, because we want to continue making work that is meaningful to you. And right now, I want to let you know what's happening at WBUR. Our radio shows, our podcasts are getting some of the biggest audiences we've ever had. Our journalism is winning awards, reaching new and more diverse audiences. And you are a big part of that. Our journalism has never been stronger, but the business has never been harder. We've had a big loss of sponsorship dollars, like a lot of media companies have in recent years. But one thing we've always been pretty good at is getting support from our listeners to make the things they love. So we're asking right now, in a crucial moment for WBUR, can you help us get through this by joining other listeners in supporting WBUR? We need your help to keep making the podcast you're listening to right now, along with everything else that comes from WBUR. Your help would mean a lot to me and to all of my colleagues. So please, head to our website, WBUR.org. Thanks.
WBUR Podcasts, Boston.
I'm Daryl C. Murphy, and you're listening to The Common. Beth Schwartzapfel, welcome to The Common.
Thanks for having me, Daryl.
So you are a staff writer with The Marshall Project, a nonprofit newsroom that covers the criminal justice system. And you're also the host and reporter of Violation, a new podcast from The Marshall Project and WBUR. Congratulations, first of all.
Thank you very much.
So this podcast tackles some very challenging topics around who gets second chances and whether there's such a thing as enough when it comes to prison time, right? And you tell this story primarily through one person's journey, Jake Weidman. Tell me about him.
Yeah, so Jake Weidman is the son of a celebrated author, John Edgar Weidman. Mm. And he was raised in Laramie, Wyoming, in a very stable, middle-class home, you know, Volvo station wagon, piano lessons, all the things. Mm-hmm. And one summer, he went off to summer camp, and the oldest kids in his summer camp, 16-year-olds in their summer camp, got to go on this epic road trip to the West. And one night, completely out of the clear blue, he stabbed his sleeping roommate to death when he was 16. So Jake and the boy that he killed were 16. And it just took everyone completely by surprise, including Jake, for that matter. And what we're looking at in this podcast is, you know, we're kind of going beyond the question of who did it, you know, is he guilty, is he not guilty, which is the question that preoccupies a lot of podcasts about crime. We know Jake mm-hmm. did it. We know that from the outset. So what we're trying to grapple with is, okay, then what? What happens when you are a young person who does something terrible and, you know, you put in decades in prison, you put in the time and the work to educate yourself, to better yourself? Like, when as a society are we ready to forgive you? When as a society are we ready to say, you served your sentence, you did your time, and now you have a chance to try again, to do it right this time as an adult? Mm. And I think that those are not answers that your average American can agree on. And so mm-hmm. that's why they're hard questions. And that's kind of what we're digging into with Violation.
Yeah, that's some heavy stuff. It sounds like you're talking about, or you're in the realm of, restorative justice.
In a way. I mean, I think the idea of restorative justice has kind of gotten traction over the last decade or so as our country has kind of come around to this idea that we put too many people in prison for too long. Mm-hmm. But it's very unusual for a formal setting like that, where somebody who has done wrong can sit down across a table from somebody who they've wronged and make amends, you know, answer whatever questions they want answered, explain what's going on with them. Jake is kind of funneled into the much more traditional process, which in Arizona, where the crime takes place, is the parole board. So mm-hmm. in a way, parole boards are set up to ask those questions that you ask in a restorative justice setting. But unlike in a restorative justice setting, where the goal is to make the victim's family, if not whole, because you can't ever do that, at least feel some sense of peace and understanding, parole boards are really almost like a yes or no question. Do we let you out or do we not? Mm-hmm. And so people who go before a parole board have to answer all those difficult questions. What were you thinking? What were you feeling? Why did you do that? What have you done to make sure you'll never do that again? Who are you now? Who were you then? But unlike in a restorative justice setting where the goal is to come to some sort of greater understanding, in a parole board setting, literally the end of the hearing is just a yes or no question. Okay, with all of that in mind, do we think that you're safe and ready to go home or not? And, you know, the answer can be no over and over and over again, literally for the rest of somebody's life. And that's in the hands of these parole board members.
And so this podcast, right, you're examining our nation's parole systems, which you say can be pretty opaque, right? What do you mean by that?
You know, the American tradition with trials, right, with courts, is that they're open. You know, you can walk into a court today, any court you want, and for the most part, unless it's like a juvenile court, you can actually sit in on a trial. You can sit in on a hearing. They're public, right, because that's the public acting on your behalf. Mm-hmm. You can walk into a clerk's office and request records from any court case going back any number of years. But when it comes to parole, none of those rules apply. So many parole boards are closed to the public or closed to varying degrees. So, for instance, in Massachusetts, lifer hearings for people who are serving life sentences with parole are open to the public, but all other parole board hearings are closed. So if you wanted to know, you know, what's the board thinking when it's weighing whether to release somebody who has a drug conviction? Or what's the parole board thinking when the board's deciding what to do about somebody who has a domestic violence conviction? You can't know that. You cannot walk into the Massachusetts parole board and watch a hearing unless it's a lifer hearing. So there's that aspect of it being closed. And then the other aspect is in many states, their documents and their paperwork are not available to the public. So all these decisions are being made largely in the dark.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more from Beth.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Beth, violation covers America's parole system, right? Did you look at any parole stories that took place in Boston or Massachusetts?
Yeah, we did. In one of the episodes, we briefly mentioned an incident that happened in Massachusetts in 2011. There was a man who was paroled in 2009. He had served many, many years for a series of armed robberies and assaults that he had committed in the 70s to feed his drug habit. And in 2009, this man, Dominic Sinelli, went before the parole board. His hair was gray and thinning. He was wearing reading glasses. You know, he said he was a different man who'd gotten a handle on his drug addiction and deserved a second chance. And, you know, by all indications, he was a good bet. The board looked at him and he seemed ready. He'd served enough time, you know, given the gravity of his crimes. And so they released him. And, you know, for about 2 years, he flew under the radar. And then in 2011, it's not entirely clear what happened, but he may have relapsed. He tried to rob a department store. And in the process, he got into a shootout with a police officer. And that police officer was killed. So you can imagine the outrage that the parole board released this guy who went out and killed a police officer. And what ended up happening was the governor at the time, Deval Patrick, demanded that the entire board resign. So I believe it was the entire board. There may have been one person who didn't vote on Sinelli's release who got to stay. And on one hand, like, that makes sense, right? You hear that and you're like, hell yeah. You know, they released this guy who killed a cop. Like, they should be punished. But on the other hand, you know, I think the problem with that is twofold. The first is, how in the world were they supposed to know that this guy was going to go off the deep end? You know, there's very few rules and guidelines that they have to follow. You know, many parole board members say that they just rely on their gut, on their conscience. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, the fallout from that is almost universally, and this happens from state to state periodically. Every few years, something like this happens in one state or another. And then in the years that follow, parole rates drop like precipitously. Like, parole lifer rates dropped in Massachusetts for a decade after that happened. And the truth is, like, all those people who probably would have done fine are essentially punished for this one man's bad act. And, you know, it's policy by anecdote. It's not how you want to run your justice system.
You know, after reporting this podcast, what do people misunderstand about parole?
Well, two things. First is that it's somehow getting out early. You know, that if somebody gets out on parole, they're somehow pulling a fast one on the system, or, you know, getting out on a technicality or something like that. Whereas if you get a sentence that has parole built into it, that's been part of the deal, you know, from the beginning. You know, most cases are settled by plea now, right? It's the rare case that goes to trial anymore. And so when people take a plea, the prosecutor will say to them, look, I'm going to offer you this. I'm going to offer you 10, 15 years to life or whatever it is. And the understanding that both the person who takes the plea and that the prosecutor and the judge all have from the beginning is that after a certain number of years, you'll go before a parole board. And the whole point of the parole board is, if you've done the work and you've changed, that you can get out. So it's not getting out early. It's built into your sentence from the outset. And the second thing is, look, there's plenty of people out there who are going to say, you know, don't come crying to me if you don't get parole. Like, you shouldn't have done the crime. And I'm sympathetic to that. I get it. But the problem is that once you get the sense that it's sort of arbitrary who's going to get parole, like, why should I bother trying? Like, I keep doing all the things they tell me to do, and then I go back and they say, nah, you're just not ready. People really spiral after that. And it gives the younger guys who are watching this happen to the older guys the sense that they shouldn't bother trying either, because they're not going to get parole anyway. And so I'm not here to defend whether a state should have parole or not, because some states do and some states don't. But if you do have it, it has to be meaningful for it to have its intended effect, which is to incentivize people to do well.
I feel like you're touching on something that is very central to the American identity, and it is this love of punishment.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
yep.
So what can folks expect when they listen to Violation?
Yeah, so you can expect to meet Jake. You'll meet his family. You'll meet his father, which is something that I'm really excited about. His father, John Edgar Wideman, is an author whose books I've been reading and grappling with for years. And John Edgar Wideman is most famous for a memoir he wrote before Jake killed Eric Kane, which is about John Wideman's brother, Robbie, who's serving a life sentence, or who was serving a life sentence in prison for a robbery gone wrong where a man was killed. So the echoes through the generations of, you know, how is it possible that Jake Wideman, another Wideman, was involved in a murder? So we're looking at all that stuff, generational trauma, we're looking at racism, and we're going to take you on a tour of parole boards, how they work, how they don't work. You'll meet parole board members. We'll walk you through Jake's time in prison, and hopefully we'll leave you kind of pondering with some pretty hard questions.
Where can people listen?
At WBUR, at The Marshall Project, or wherever they get their podcasts.
Beth, Congratulations on Violation, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Daryl. I really appreciate it.
That's host and reporter of Violation, Beth Schwartzapfel. And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to The Common. If you have any thoughts on this episode, hit us up on Instagram, Twitter, or TikTok at WBURTheCommon. You can also send us an email at thecommon@wbur.org. I'm Daryl C. Murphy, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.